From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum, a new diet that could stop or even reverse the effects of chronic diseases like cancer, heart disease, diabetes, or dementia. Maybe not a diet, but a lifestyle. Physician, researcher, and UCSF professor Dean Ornish has been working for years as one of the foremost experts on lifestyle medicine, and he explores this further in his new book, Undo It. Dean Ornish joins us in the studio next after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. UCSF physician, researcher, and author Dean Ornish has long been a big proponent of a lifestyle-driven approach to fighting disease. And now, in their new book, Undo It, Dean and co-author Ann Ornish outline lifestyle changes that they say can help prevent and reverse chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, and depression. Dean Ornish is the founder of the nonprofit Preventive Medicine Research Institute in Sausalito, author of 6 best-selling books, and he joins us for this Forum Hour. Welcome, Dean Ornish. Good to have you back.
Michael, it's great to be here again.
I guess the place to begin here is to say that you have been really a major innovator and have had breakthroughs in medicine, particularly in heart disease and prostate cancer, that have really not only put you on the map, but that have gained fame and extraordinary recognition for you. But here you have a unifying theory of chronic diseases. When I hear unifying theory, I think of Einstein, no less, as I suppose many of my listeners do. But we're really talking about chronic diseases that are very different in terms of, well, the trajectory of those diseases and how they travel and how they traverse through the body or the mind.
Exactly. Well, in this book, I present this new unifying theory, which is that, like most doctors, I was trained to view heart disease as being very different than diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol or obesity or prostate cancer or Alzheimer's or so many different conditions. And what I'm proposing in this new book is that they're really not different, that they're really different manifestations of the same underlying biological mechanisms that get disordered, things like chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, changes in the microbiome, in gene expression, in telomeres, in angiogenesis, and so on. And in turn, each one of these biological mechanisms is directly influenced by what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise we get, and how much love and support we have. Or to reduce it even further, to, you know, eat well, move more, stress less, love more. Boom, that's it. And the more diseases we study and the more underlying biological mechanisms we look at, the more reasons we have to explain why these simple changes are so powerful and how quickly people can get better. It also helps to explain why, you know, in this era of personalized medicine, if you have a pancreatic tumor or melanoma and they do a targeted immunotherapy for that particular cell line, that's awesome. But for the vast majority of chronic diseases, in the 40 years of research that we've done, published in all the major leading peer-reviewed medical journals, it wasn't like there was one set of diet and lifestyle recommendations for reversing heart disease, a different one for diabetes or prostate cancer, et cetera. It was really the same for all of them. And the reason is that they are all different manifestations of these same underlying mechanisms. And it also helps explain why, for example, many people have what are called comorbidities. In other words, they'll have diabetes and high blood pressure and be overweight and high cholesterol and heart disease, because, again, they're all just different manifestations of the same thing. And why in other countries, like in Asia 50 years ago in China, they had very low rates of these chronic diseases, even though they have the same genetic diversity that we have in this country. But then when they start to eat like us and live like us, they all too often die like us, because then those genes get expressed. And so it's a way of kind of radically simplifying and helping people understand. You know, people often think, well, you know, how powerful could diet and lifestyle be, you know? It has to be.
Especially when I may have genes that are going to lead me in treacherous areas in terms of my own health.
Exactly. And you know, I think our unique contribution has been to use these very high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art scientific measures to prove how powerful these very simple and low-tech and low-cost interventions can be. And you mentioned genes, for example. You know, when I was in medical school, we were taught the only way to change your genes is to change your parents. You know, in other words, it's impossible. But we did a study published with Craig Venter, who, as you know, was the first to decode the human genome, showing that these same lifestyle changes could actually change your gene expression. In effect, turning on the genes that keep us healthy, turning off the genes that cause us to get these chronic diseases.
This is all day-to-day choices you're talking about, really, for the most part.
That's right. The same ones. Eat well, move more, stress less, love more. Over 500 genes were changed in just 3 months, particularly downregulating the genes that cause these same mechanisms, chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, and so on, and particularly downregulating what are called the oncogenes that promote prostate, breast, and colon cancer. It's just amazing how dynamic these mechanisms are, that you can get better quickly, you can get worse very quickly.
Are you talking, though, about people, for the most part, who have afflictions or who have illness or who are suffering in some way? Or is this really kind of a diet and a regimen that everybody can do for prophylactically?
Well, it's a good question. I think our unique contribution has been to show that we can actually reverse these chronic diseases. We were the first to show you could reverse heart disease or slow stop or even reverse the progression of early stage prostate cancer. We're doing the first randomized control trial now to see if we can actually reverse early stage Alzheimer's disease. And if any listeners, by the way, are interested in volunteering, we're doing this in collaboration with Bruce Miller, who runs the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, and Joel Kramer and their colleagues there. And we've already started the intervention, but we're still recruiting people. So if you know anyone who lives in the greater Bay Area who has early stage Alzheimer's, it's all done for free to the patients. Just go to ornish.com, our website, and there's information on how you can enroll in that.
Are you working with Dale Bredesen at all? Or?
Well, you know, Dale and I, Dale based his program on my work. He's talked about this publicly. And
he did on our show, in fact. Yeah, he was at the Buck Institute for many years. Now he's at UCLA. I should mention who he is.
And he did a
book on Alzheimer's. Yeah,
that's right. Well, we diverged because my approach has always been, let's do randomized trials to see if something works. And if it works, then I'll write a book about it. He wanted to just get it out there. And, you know, there's just different approaches. And so he wrote his book, and I'm doing a randomized trial now. And if it works, then we'll put it out there, too. But our approach has really been about, my approach and my colleagues has been about reversing disease. And, you know, 5% the patients in this country, 5% of the people account for 80% of the healthcare costs, of the $3.6 trillion in healthcare costs that we have. And so by focusing on these people, clearly if you can reverse something, you can help prevent it. And it probably takes less to prevent disease than it does to reverse it. My earlier book called The Spectrum was based on the idea that the more you change, the better you get in every way we could measure at any age, which is a very empowering message. So if you indulge yourself one day, eat healthier the next, that what matters most is your overall way of eating and living. But in this book, it's really focused on reversing disease. And again, how you can reverse these chronic diseases, how, you know, it's really about treating the cause. You know, I've been lecturing for 40 years showing this cartoon of doctors busily mopping up the floor around a sink that's overflowing, but nobody's turning off the faucet. It's like when people get put on medications to lower their cholesterol, their blood pressure, their blood sugar, and they say, doctor, how long do I have to take these? The doctor usually says, forever, right? It's like, how long do I have to mop up the floor? Forever. Like, well, why don't we just turn off the faucet? And what I keep getting struck by, Michael, over and over again, and it's even after 40 years, still amazes me, is that our bodies have this, in many cases, this remarkable capacity to begin healing, and much more quickly than we had once thought possible, if we can turn off the faucet. In other words, if we can treat the cause, and the cause in turn are what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise we get, and how much love and support we have.
Seems to me, though, I was talking to Dean Ornish, by the way, founder and president of the nonprofit Preventive Medicine Research Institute, and clinical professor of medicine at UCSF, and co-author of Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. He's even made me no longer susceptible to the word lifestyle. Susan Sontag years ago said, you shouldn't use the word lifestyle because if you have a lifestyle, you don't have a life. But now we have lifestyle medicine has become really part of our lexicon in a very familiar way. I'm often thinking about the breakdown of different diseases, though, and how different they are. And yet what you're saying certainly makes a great deal of sense, but you're also bringing it into line with things like yoga and spiritual seeking and meditation, all of these things, which, again, Dale Bredesen brings into his approach as well. The idea—
Because, again, he based it on my work, that's why.
Well, your work has certainly had a lot of success to it, and in fact, now it's being, pretty much sponsored in terms of Mutual of Omaha, and you've got Blue Cross and Blue Shield.
And Medicare actually created a whole
Medicare
new benefit
now, right. They're all there with you, and you know, many people have certainly given you worthy plaudits for the work you've done. I'm just somewhat hesitant to a few things, so let me give you a little bit of the skepticism here.
Before I get into that, because you mentioned Susan Sontag. Susan Sontag, who is a brilliant writer, of course, wrote a book that basically said, you know, your mind doesn't affect your body, and that it's all in your genes. And she was wrong. and you're blaming people, you know. And there's a big difference between blaming and empowering. You know, I've been working with President Clinton since 1993, and 9 years ago when his bypass is clogged up, one of his cardiologists held a press conference saying, oh, it was all in his genes and his diet and lifestyle had nothing to do with it. And I sent him a note and said, well, it actually has everything to do with it. And again, not to blame, but to empower. Because if it's just all in our genes, then we're victims. And I said, you're not a victim. You're one of the most powerful guys in the world. And that's when he began making these changes. And 9 years later, he's still doing it. And I think whatever your politics, you know, that really sets a good example for everyone.
Speaking of President Clinton, I mean, I want to get back to something along those lines. But I'm just interested in how these diseases fall into a kind of similar gestalt for you, or again, are not necessarily separate, because treatment certainly, and as you say, still I'm certain that in medical school, the way you were trained, is pretty much the same now. You take these diseases, you isolate them, you silo them, you look at them in different ways, and that's the nature of the beast, so to speak.
Yeah, silo is a good way to put it. And they're not only individual siloed, but even within each disease, they're siloed. But I think that where medicine is finally moving is into translational medicine, into medicine of really seeing how this all plays together, that we kind of miss the forest for the trees. There's that old joke about the guy who loses his wallet over in the dark alley but looks for it under the street lamp because the light's better there. You know, we tend to focus on what we can measure. And so I think that's changing. And part of what excites me here is that, you know, in this book, we try to radically simplify. You know, the nice thing, if I asked you to write a book about how to do a show interviewing people, you know, you could really reduce it down to its essence because you're brilliant at this. You've been doing it a long time. And the book starts with one of my favorite quotes, which is from Albert Einstein, that says, if you can't make it simple, you don't understand it well enough. And so what Anne and I have tried to do in this book is to radically simplify this. Eat well, move more, stress less, love more. Boom, that's it.
Reminds me of Michael Pollan a bit.
In a sense, yeah. Eat food, mostly plants, you know, not too much. And it is radically simple. And Steve Jobs, you know, when he came out with the iPhone, it's a complex technology, but part of his brilliance was to make it so simple that any 2-year-old can pick it up and use it and do that. And so we wanted our book to have that same approach. And by radically simplifying it, it also helps people to understand why these simple changes are so powerful and how quickly you can feel better. And to make them not just to live longer, which is not a sustainable motivator, but because you feel so much better. Your brain gets more blood. You think more clearly. You have more energy. You need less sleep. Depression scores are cut in half. You can grow so many new brain neurons through a process called neurogenesis that your brain can get measurably bigger in just a few weeks to a few months, and particularly the part of your brain called the hippocampus, as you know, that controls memory. Your skin gets more blood, so you don't age as quickly. Your heart gets more blood. You can reverse heart disease. Even your sexual organs get more blood flow in the same way that Viagra works. And so there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better and quickly. And because these biological mechanisms we've been talking about are so dynamic, to the degree you make these lifestyle changes, most people feel so much better so quickly, it reframes the reason for making them from fear of dying or fear of something bad happening, which is not sustainable, to joy and pleasure and love and meaning and feeling good, which really are.
Yeah, but intimacy and love play an important part in this too, as you write. And I remember the first interview I did with you many years ago when you were talking about the depression you went through as a kid in Texas and, you know, the difficulty you had, suicidal ideation, all that sort of thing. Now,
yeah,
rich, famous, wonderful family life, everything seems to be coming up roses. But, you know, the fact is you can use yourself here as, I suppose, a paradigm. You pretty happy now?
I'm very happy now. I don't know how rich I am, but I'm very happy now. And you know, for me, being suicidally depressed was my doorway into this whole area.
And you want to help people, and you have helped an enormous number of people, and that certainly needs to be recognized. Can we talk, though, about intimacy? Actually, before I talk about intimacy with you, let's talk about diet, because you got 70 recipes in this book, and I'm interested in, I think, you know, we've talked about this before. There are the intransigent people like myself. no, I mean, I'm a carnivore, and I find it very difficult to stop eating, even though I have diabetes, stop eating carbs, stop eating sugar, stop eating beef and meat, because, you know, life is supposed to give you pleasure. And I think if I'm on a vegan diet, I'm not going to be living a pleasurable life or a joyful life. Now, that's foolish, I know, and it's stupid, and it's self-destructive. But I probably like a lot of people who are like me in this way. I want to help the environment. I'd like to be off meat. We've had this discussion before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a vice, maybe, and it's a vice that's there with me.
Well, I prefer not to use, I mean, the whole language of behavioral change has this kind of moralistic, judgmental quality. It's a vice, as you put it.
I'm being judgmental about myself.
But I'm going to make the sign of the cross here. You are forgiven, you know. It's not
Jewish
about...
Jewish guy giving the sign of the cross.
Two guys, right? It's not about judgment. You know, the whole language of behavioral change is this kind of fascist, moralistic, judgmental, finger-wagging quality to it. You know, like once you call foods good or bad, it's a very small step to saying I'm a bad person because I ate bad food, or it's a vice, or I cheated on my diet, or, you know, although, you know, or the other side of that, which is like, as you said, I want to enjoy my life. And
but it is messing up your health. It's messing up the environment, and yet...
True.
It is.
Well, it's true. And as you know, more global warming is caused by livestock consumption than all forms of transportation combined. I used to get into friendly debates with Al Gore, and he became a vegan about 5 years ago, even though he's a cattle rancher. You know, I grew up in Texas eating meat 3 or 4 times a day.
He was also a tobacco raiser, wasn't he?
I don't know about that. But anyway, but the point is that so often people say, well, what can I do as one person to make a difference in the environment? And something as primal as what we eat every day, you know, even a meatless Monday, if you don't want to be a vegan, just, you know, to the degree you do that, there's a corresponding benefit. It's good for you. It's good for the planet. And also, it takes 14 times more resources to make a pound of meat-based protein than plant-based protein. I was on the board of directors of the San Francisco Food Bank, and I was shocked to hear that 1 out of 5 kids in the Bay Area goes to bed hungry every night. That's just not acceptable. And it turns out that there's enough food to feed everybody. If more people move towards eating a plant-based diet, it frees up tremendous resources, so nobody need go hungry. But the biggest obstacle is one that I think you mentioned that's worth taking a moment to talk about, which is that, you know, it's like, am I going to live longer? Or is it just going to seem longer? You know, the only way you get to live to be 100 is by not doing all the things that would make you want to live to be 100, and variations on that theme. And, you do all these great lectures on humor, and it's fair game for that. But the fact is that there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better and quickly. And there's a great scene in James Cameron has this film that he did with Luis Cienfuegos called Game Changers that should be out in another month or two. And, you know, Cameron did all those great movies like Terminator and
Titanic
and Avatar and all that. And he became a vegan. He and his wife, Susie, became a vegan about 8 or 9 years ago for environmental reasons, for what we've been talking about, because he's an explorer as well as a filmmaker. And he felt so much better. He's actually making Avatars 2, 3, and 4 at the same time now. He's got so much energy. But the biggest misconception of eating a plant-based diet is that it's not going to be fun, as you indicate, and you don't get enough protein, and you're kind of a wimp. So he made this film with Luis Cienfuegos, and Luis got an Academy Award for The Cove, the great film about the dolphin slaughter of in Japan. And they interviewed all these great world-class athletes and found that they elevated their game when they went on a plant-based diet. They became Olympic medalists and cyclists and heavyweight boxing champions and mixed martial artists champions, national champions, and so on. And I was one of the experts in that film, and so I got to spend some time with them. And there's one great scene in this movie with a urologist named Aaron Spitz, and they take these three elite athletes in their mid-20s, and they feed them a meat-based meal, one meal. And it's a high-quality meat-based meal. It's organic beef and grass-fed beef and organic chicken and so on. And then they measured at night, using this device, the frequency and the hardness of the erections that they had at night, because it's a natural phenomenon. Guys have erections when they sleep. And then they gave them a plant-based meal that looked exactly the same, kind of disguised, and measured the same thing the following night. And what they found is in all three guys, they had 300 to 500% more frequent erections and 10 to 15% harder erections after the plant-based meal than after the meat-based meal. Apparently, the film crew became vegan after shooting this film.
Yeah, you even have a section in your book about erectile dysfunction and all of that, so it certainly dovetails with what you're saying now.
Because it's a systemic issue. It's all of the blood vessels. So, I mean, I've been writing for years that even a single meal can reduce blood flow to your heart or your brain, but that's not as motivating as that it can actually affect blood flow to your sexual organs as well. Again, what you gain is so much more than what you give up in ways that really matter to people.
What about Mediterranean diet? They say that's the best diet there is. What about risk factors and going on that, staying on that?
The Mediterranean diet is a better diet than what most people eat, but it's never been proven to reverse heart disease. There was a study that came out of the New England Journal of Medicine called the PREDIMED study, which they actually retracted and then they republished it. And it claimed that compared to a, quote, low-fat diet, that the Mediterranean diet had people had fewer heart attacks and fewer strokes. But when you look at the study carefully, what they actually found was that, first of all, the diet they were comparing to that they called a low-fat diet it went from 39% to 37% fat, hardly any reduction at all. They replaced fat with sugar, which is never a good idea. But even then, they found no reduction in cardiovascular deaths between the two groups. It was only in the risk of stroke. And 90% of strokes are caused by blood clots. And when you eat omega-3 fatty acids that you find in fatty fish, but you can also get them from plant-based sources, which is really where they come from, which is what we do. It reduces the risk of stroke because it reduces the blood clot formation. So the Mediterranean diet is a better diet. But in fact, the only diet that's actually been proven to reverse heart disease in randomized controlled clinical trials is a whole foods plant-based diet like the one we're talking about.
Talking to Dean Ornish again, and let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation. As I said, I want to talk about a range of other things with him, including intimacy, which we'll get to here. I also want to find out about, there is almost a book within the book here of blurbs. I said to Dean before we went on the air, I mean, he's got a lot of scientists and very leading people in fields of medicine and so many other areas, but they're also Beyonce, I thought when I read this, Trisha Yearwood, Barbara Streisand. I mean, you got some real kind of Hollywood stellar folks here in terms of plugs, which is sort of a fascinating story, I'm sure, in itself. You mentioned James Cameron, how you made all these contacts in Hollywood and developed all these relationships. But let me give out the phone number and invite you to join us. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Feel free to join us with any questions or comments you might have.
Let me just jump in real quick. You know, we live in a celebrity-driven culture, and to me, awareness is always the first step in healing. And celebrities have a great platform, and it's a great way of reaching a lot of people. But as you say, there are also quotes in there from the president of the American College of Cardiology, the editor-in-chief of JAMA Internal Medicine, the former Surgeon General, former Nobel Prize winners, head of the Sinclair Lab at Harvard, et cetera. So we tried to get a nice mix of everything.
Well, you helped a lot of people, I mean, from all walks of life, and continue to do that, as I said earlier. I was just, not necessarily starstruck, I was just struck by all the all the heavyweight Hollywood people and people in popular entertainment and popular world. And they do, of course. I mean, they even give testimony in front of Congress now and go up and do that sort of thing. So they have become very much the popular culture part of, what weighs with many people and brings. We're coming up on a break here, but you're not intimate with all these stars, by the way. I mean, you have a close relationship with a lot of them.
Many of them are patients or people I've consulted with.
So let's talk about intimacy in general, though, as we come up on the break here, and what that means in terms of preventing, not even necessarily preventing, but dealing with chronic disease.
What, the role of intimacy?
Yeah.
It's a good question. You know, study after study have shown...
Dean, I'm sorry, you're going to have to hold it because we're too close to the break here.
Okay.
But I want to get to that. We'll get to our callers, too. If you're on the line, hang on, and you can also join us again by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or, as I said, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. And we're going to also talk about, I hope, spirituality, because that comes into this, too, and... Dean Ornish co-authored his book with Ann Ornish, his wife. He said it's kind of a yin-yang relationship. They do this together. He talks about the what, and she talks about the what. He talks about the how. And I should mention there are a lot of recipes in the book and so forth, and he'll be at the Commonwealth Club. Why would I mention that? It's sold out. But you can join us live. Please feel free to do that. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In their new book, Undo It, Dean and Ann Ornish outline lifestyle changes that they say can help prevent, even reverse, the effects of chronic diseases like cancer, diabetes, and depression. And Dr. Ornish is here with us in studio to talk about what he sees as the real components of a healthy diet and explain why meaningful relationships matter and discuss how going vegan can turn the tide on heart disease. We've covered a lot of that. We haven't gotten into intimacy. We've got a lot of callers waiting, obviously, but meaningful relationships and intimacy, and how does that figure into this equation?
You know, when people say, yeah, diet I get, I got to eat, it's just a question of what, and exercise, you're actually out there doing something, and even meditation, I can sort of see that, but love and support, like, what does that have to do with it? What's love got to do with it, right?
Especially people who go solo in life and do it by themselves, right?
That's right. But intimacy doesn't have to be between even between people. It can be having a dog. It can be, you know, there's lots of ways of doing that. But the idea is that I've been so struck by the research showing there are literally tens of thousands of studies that show that people who are lonely and depressed are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely from virtually all causes when compared to those who have a sense of love and connection and community. And I don't know anything, even smoking, that has that much of an impact. And there's been a radical shift in our culture in the last 50 years with the breakdown of those social networks where that used to give that to people. You know, 50 years ago, most people had an extended family they saw regularly. They had a neighborhood with two or three generations of people. They had a job that felt secure. They got to know their fellow employees. They'd been out for 10 years or more. They had a church or synagogue or club or something that they belonged to. And many people today have none of those. And, you know, Facebook, you know, is one way of getting 1.5 billion people together. But it's not really an authentic intimacy. Intimacy, you know, people don't post their demons on their Facebook profile or their whatever. You know, it looks like in fact, one of the studies I quote in my new book is that the more time you spend on Facebook, the more depressed you are because it looks like everybody has this perfect life but you. And yet when you grow up in an extended family, they know you. They don't just know your Facebook profile or your bio sketch or all those nice things that you said about me at the beginning of the show. They know where you messed up. They know your demons. They know where you broke that window or, you know, got arrested or whatever it was or got into drugs. And they're still there for you. And there's just something really primal about the need for that sense of community. I think that's one of the reasons why people listen to your show, because you really bring people together in ways that people trust. And trust is really an essential component to intimacy, because you can only be intimate to the degree you can open your heart and be vulnerable. And you can only do that to the degree you feel like you can be safe and trust someone. And so what we do to try to recreate that in our studies and in our programs that, you know, we've trained hospitals and clinics around the country, and that Medicare and Aetna and Blue Cross and others are now paying for, the support groups are really designed to recreate that sense of safety where somebody, it's not about helping people stay on the diet or types of running shoes. It's really creating a safe environment where people can let down their emotional defenses and just say, hey, I may look like the perfect father, but my kid's on drugs or whatever. And someone else, instead of saying, oh, well, why don't you send them to a drug rehab program, like they hadn't thought of that, which only makes you feel more isolated, can say, oh, that must be awful. Or, gosh, my kid has a problem. Or I used to have a drug problem, they might say, or whatever it is. And suddenly they feel more, it's like in that great movie Avatar that we talked about, James Cameron, earlier, I see you, you know, which is really from an African proverb. I see you, all of you, not just your bio sketch or your good stuff, but I see all of you and I'm still there for you. And
there's the problem with Facebook is nobody sees anybody on Facebook if they don't talk in eye-to-eye contact or anything like that. Since you mentioned Facebook, I'd also want to mention and maybe even plug a fine book by Robert Putnam, which I'm sure you know because you were talking like right out of a Bowling Alone. Right?
Yeah, Bowling Alone.
Let me get some callers on here with you, though. A lot of people want to talk to you and ask questions. And James, you're up first. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Great subject matter. Unfortunately, I just tuned in to the show, and I didn't catch your guest's name.
Dr. Dean Ornish, O-R-N-I-S-H.
Thank you. I have a great question for you. I'm 49, avid surfer, really good job, work a lot of hours. I'm trying to kick the meat diet. I'm doing pretty well, but I have a really high metabolism, and I'm having problems substituting fat. So if I go without fat, like, say, animal fats, for more than, like, 2 weeks, I get this really bizarre headache, and then I find myself wanting to just basically drink fat to feel so much better. So what can I use to substitute a plant-based fat for animal-based fat?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the question. I'm not sure that you're getting headaches because of the fat. It may be that you're just detoxifying from being on an animal protein diet. But, you know, there's certainly a number of sources of plant-based fats that you can consume, you know, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and soy products all have some fat in them. Oils are 100% fat. So if you really feel like you need more
coconut oil for that.
Sorry?
I said I use coconut oil.
Coconut oil is not a good choice because it's really high in what are called medium chain triglycerides, and there's a big fad on coconut oil, but it's actually been debunked by the people who actually have done studies on that. But if you're going to have fat, either, you know, canola oil or olive oil or things like that, but it may be that you don't need as, I mean, especially if you're not losing weight, I'm not sure that you necessarily need more fat. Try just eating a whole foods plant-based diet, and my guess is not only your headaches will go away, but you'll feel better, and even your performance may improve.
Let me thank you for the call, James, and we'll go on to more calls here, but let me read a comment by Al, which is really a question. He says, Steve Jobs was a subset of veganism, eating only fruits, nuts, seeds, vegetables, and grains, absolutely no animal products. However, he never was able to reverse his cancer. Can you please comment on that?
Well, Steve wasn't a vegan. He was a pescatarian, and Steve was one of my closest friends, and I was intimately involved in his care. And But
he believed he could really control the kind of pancreatic cancer he had, which was a kind of almost obscure cancer in many ways compared to what normally people have in pancreatic cancer, wasn't it?
Well, yes, and the New York Times asked about this, and his wife, Lorene, gave me permission to talk about this part of it, and because people think I was the one who told him not to have surgery, when it was actually just the opposite. When he was diagnosed, he got diagnosed at a very early stage. It was a neuroendocrine type of pancreatic cancer, and he said, well, let me try diet and lifestyle first, and I said, well, you know, you're really playing with fire here because it hasn't spread yet, although you never know, it might have spread microscopically. But he wanted to try it, so he tried it for a few months, and the test showed that it wasn't getting better. And I said, you know, I think he really needs to have surgery. So with his permission, I got all of his other doctors together, and we met and talked about, reviewed all the studies and all the data, and then we agreed with one voice that he really should have surgery and went over to his house and went on a long walk with him. And I said, Steve, you know, you're not going to find a doctor in the country who's more strongly supportive of using diet and lifestyle to reverse chronic diseases, but we all think you really need surgery. And he still wanted to wait. Now, and then it did spread, and then he ultimately had the surgery. Now, hindsight is 20/20. It's easy to say, gosh, you know, he should have done that. But who knew, you know, because it was very rare to discover the disease at such an early stage. We were actually looking for something else and found it as an incidental finding. So, you know, who knew? It might have worked. It might not have. It's hindsight of 2020. And even if he had the surgery, it might have spread anyway. But I miss him terribly. He was a really great person, and I loved him, and it's a void in my life.
More of your calls. Priya joins us next. Priya from Cupertino. Good morning.
Good morning. So my question was regarding Indian diet, because most Indians are either vegetarian, or a lot of Indians are actually either vegetarian or vegan. They won't even eat, you know, root vegetables. Forget about animal fat. I'm not talking about the curry-based diets from restaurants, but Indian home-cooked food is actually very plant-based and, you know, less fat. What do you think about this kind of diet versus Mediterranean diets?
Well, a whole foods plant-based diet, as we've talked about earlier, is better than a Mediterranean diet. A Mediterranean diet is better than the standard American diet, for sure. But, you know, so often, in I've been to India many times, there's a lot of ghee and butter and clarified butter and animal, I'm not animal fat, but other kinds of fat, a lot of salt. And so it's not, even though it's plant-based, it's not always the healthiest plant-based, but it's definitely a step in the right direction and better than a Mediterranean diet.
And we thank you for the call. That's Priya. And we go to Corey next. Corey, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi, thank you. I've been a fan of Dr. Ornish's, and I've been a fan of Michael Pollan, and I'm wondering, I'm now a fan of Gary Taub. I'm wondering if you're familiar with his work. Specifically, I'm concerned about the question of moderation in diet, and people say that, but it usually seems like a skinny person telling a fat person to be more moderate in their choices. I'm not really sure how you could define that if you take it out of the context of getting fatter.
It's a good question, Corey, and I thank you for it. Too much of anything is no good, my mother used to say. But how do you define moderation, Dean Orner?
Someone once said moderation in all things, even moderation. But well, Michael Pollan has done great work. He's a friend, and I have great affection and admiration for what he's doing. Gary Taubes, on the other hand, I've had many debates with. I've stopped doing those kinds of those diet wars, you know, and who makes claims? I mean, it's you know, Gary Taubes, the paleo, the keto diet, the Atkins diet. They're just Atkins redux. And I debated Dr. Atkins many times before he died. And his autopsy, which was publicly released, showed that he died of heart failure.
I think he called in once when you were on the air with me.
That's right. I forgot about that. So, you know, I love to be able to tell people that, you know, fat and pork rinds and bacon and sausage are health foods, but they're not. I mean, where we all agree is that Americans eat too many refined carbs. Sugar, white flour, white rice, et cetera. And when you eat a lot of sugar and these things, your blood sugar zooms up quickly. Your pancreas makes insulin to bring it back down. But the insulin also causes chronic inflammation, which is one of the underlying causes of so many of these chronic diseases. So we agree that people should limit the amount of refined carbs. It's what you replace them with that we had a difference. And my approach is replace them with good carbs, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and soy products are rich in fiber. The fiber fills you up before you get too many calories. It slows the rate of absorption. You don't get those wide swings in insulin. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of protective substances that have anti-cancer, anti-heart disease, and anti-aging properties. Whereas so many studies are showing that it's not even just the fat versus carbs, but the animal protein itself in red meat increases your risk of premature death from all causes by 75%, and by diabetes and heart disease and the most common forms of cancer by 400 to 500%.
Well, we've got a lot of people who want to talk with you about diet, but I brought up intimacy because that's so much an important part of your whole program, and so is spirituality. And let's talk about that for a moment, if we could. What do you tell atheists, for example, or people who have really no spiritual bent? Look to nature for spiritual sustenance or things along those lines?
Well, spirituality, I use in the context of that on one level, we're separate. You know, you're you and I'm me, and we can have this wonderful dialogue together. But on another level, we're not. We're a part of something larger that connects us all. And even to give it a name is to limit what's essentially an ineffable or infinite experience, the sense of non-duality or oneness.
The numinous, I think, is the word. Yeah.
One way to look at it. Exactly. And so when we present meditation, for example, it's not simply as a way of managing stress. I mean, it is, but it's more than that. The ancient swamis and rabbis and priests and monks and nuns didn't develop meditation just to, you know, lower their blood pressure, unclog their arteries, perform better in sports. It can do all those things. But they're really about quieting down our mind and body enough to experience more of an inner sense of peace and joy and well-being and to realize that's our natural state. And so, you know, when I was suicidally depressed in college, I ended up studying with an ecumenical teacher named Swami Satchidananda. People, he liked to make puns. People say, what are you, a Hindu? He'd say, no, I'm an undo. You know? And the idea is that I was so depressed because I thought, if only
is
I
Is that where undo it comes from?
That's part of where the title comes from. That and from my favorite key on the keyboard and the computer has always been the undo button. I thought, wouldn't it be nice if we had that in our lives? And now we do. And I got so depressed because I thought, I'm never going to get into medical school and be a doctor. I'm never, people won't love me. I can't love myself. And I got into this downward spiral that so many people are doing. And what he said was that nothing can bring you lasting happiness, which I'd already figured out, which is why I was so depressed. But he went on to say that we already have that, that in what perhaps the ultimate irony in life, we end up running after these things in life that we, you know, the whole advertising industry is based on, if only you had more whatever, more money, more power, more sex, more beauty, more accomplishment, then you'd be happy, then you could love yourself, then you wouldn't feel so depressed. Now, once you set up that view of the world, until you get it, you're stressed. If someone else gets it, then you're really stressed and makes you feel like we live in this, you know, dog-eat-dog, zero-sum game world. And even if you get it, it's very seductive. It's like, ah, I got it. It's mine. But it's soon followed by either now what? It's never enough. One patient of mine said, I can't even enjoy the view from the mountain I've climbed. I'm already looking over the next one. Or so what? Big deal. It doesn't really provide that lasting sense of meaning. So they set 12 projects going on at the same time. So, but when you practice meditation, and it can be done in a spiritual, a religious, a secular way, an atheistic way, it doesn't matter, you can experience more of an inner sense of peace at the end of a meditation. And when you feel that way, to remind yourself literally, that that meditation didn't bring you that sense of peace, but at least for the moment, you weren't disturbing what's really already there. You were undoing it, if you will.
So the data supports what you're saying. I mean, the data on meditation is pretty strong. But here's someone, a naysayer, Linda, who says, the extreme non-fat diet you previously promoted, even limiting avocados and olive oil, is too difficult to follow and has been shown to be unhealthy. We need fat.
Well, you get all the fat you need on this diet. You don't get the excess fat. And, you know, our work has all been about doing peer-reviewed research, and we found that people are actually getting better and better, not worse and worse. And so this idea that, you know, low fat is dead, it's all sugar, is simply not true. It's only part of the it's part of the issue. You know, unfortunately, when I debated Dr. Atkins, as we talked about, he was the low-carb guy, so I got pegged as the low-fat guy. It's never just been about low fat. Low fat is just, it's low in sugar, it's low in fat, it's low in animal protein, but it's high in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products. You'll get all the fat you need. Plus, we encourage people to take omega-3 supplements, either the plant-based ones if you're vegan or fish oil if you're not.
Can we do a couple quick tweets and then we'll get to more calls?
Sure.
Because a lot of people want to talk to you, like I said.
Of course.
Listener tweets, what does Dr. Arnders think about the Silicon Valley starve yourself fad? We actually did a program on that. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not really sure what that is, but if you're talking about intermittent fasting, I think that's a good thing, in the sense that try to eat a heavy breakfast and lunch, a lighter dinner. Try to stop eating early, like 6 or 7 at night, and then don't eat again until 7 or 8 the next morning. So you have a 12-hour fast. Just naturally, it allows your body to sleep and get to a deeper level of sleep because you're not trying to digest your food from the meal. So then, to that extent, I think it can actually be good.
Here's a tweet from Roger. What about something like the Impossible Burger? Do our bodies react to it as plant or meat?
Well, the Impossible Burger, I think, Pat Brown is doing, who's a brilliant guy at Stanford. He invented the gene chip. The only concern, and I love the fact that the Beyond Meat Burger, I think, is also a great one. But the Impossible Burger, the only concern I have about it is that it uses heme, which you find in hemoglobin, which it gives it that kind of meaty flavor and texture. But
it's also impossible to pick up with a fork half of the time because it breaks down.
That's
so
another
quickly.
Story. But the heme is an oxidant, and it oxidizes. It causes oxidative stress to your body, and that's one of the underlying mechanisms that in this unifying theory that causes so many chronic diseases. So I think it's a step in the right direction. But I think the burgers that don't have heme are probably even better.
Here's Des. Des, you're our next caller. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. I have a question about people who maybe shouldn't be vegan for certain parts of their life or certain health reasons. And I ask that because I have a teenager who started being a vegan when he was 11 and then had to go through a couple orthopedic surgeries that required a lot of bone growth. And we saw that he had really low iron and a bunch of different things. And once we started with meat, he's had fabulous bone growth. So I'm wondering, is it about certain times of life, health issues, or maybe meat is actually healthy?
Well, no. Actually studies have shown that people post-surgery, and like one of the reasons in this Game Changer film, a guy named James Wilkes, who won the National Mixed Martial Artists Championship, got injured and was reviewed the literature and found that the people who actually eat a plant-based diet heal faster. In fact, the Roman gladiators were on a plant-based diet for that reason, because it actually makes you stronger. But, you know, Twinkies are vegan, you know, and Dr. Pepper is vegan. You can eat a vegan diet that's not healthy. And so I don't know what your son was eating, but it's important to make sure that they're getting a good variety of foods because, like on any diet, you can eat a healthy version or an unhealthy version of it.
And we thank you, Des, for the call. Julia writes, looking at the PDF from your guest's audiobook, a lot of foods are not good for people with allergies. Oats and beans don't work for me. Tofu is hard on the thyroid. I guess we're getting several comments from people who say beans and soy simply don't agree with them.
Well, you know, I grew up in Texas, and I had so many allergies that I went to allergists, and I was allergic to pretty much everything, and it had allergy shots and so on. And what people often find is that, allergies are part of a hyperactive immune response. It's one end of autoimmune diseases. And when you go and animal protein triggers you and puts you more in a hyper immune state, a chronic inflammatory state. And when people become and eat a healthy plant-based diet, they often find the things that they had been allergic to are not. But one of the things I just want to focus on was that soy. There's a lot of stuff going on the internet that soy is bad for you because it's like estrogen and hurts your thyroid and so on. But actually, soy in any kind of reasonable amounts, especially if you can get organic soy and fermented soy is the best, is actually protective because it's called it has what are called phytoestrogens, which look enough like an estrogen molecule. They'll bind to the estrogen receptor, but they only weakly stimulate it. But they keep the regular estrogen molecule from binding. It's like putting a key in a lock that doesn't fit, but it keeps the regular key that does from opening the lock. So the net effect is actually to reduce the estrogen-like effect. And estrogen is often one of the underlying mechanisms that can lead to prostate and breast cancer.
A listener wants to know about diet recommendations for people with asthma. Anything specific on that score?
Well, again, I think that the same program, and again, it's not just the diet. So often stress and exercise and social support play a role in asthma as well. Again, I used to have asthma, and I had to have bronchodilator treatments regularly. And when I changed my diet and lifestyle, those all went away. And my guess is it's worth a try, and you may find that to be true as well. Again, always under your doctor's care.
Talking to Dean Ornish, co-author of Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. And here's John from Sebastopol. John, welcome. You're on.
Hi, thank you for the call. I'm calling, I'm a recently sober individual, and I'm realizing that there's a lot of sugar in the alcohol that I was drinking before. I'm wondering, what's a good substitute for me to use now that I've cut that out of my life?
It's a good question. You know, alcohol really gets converted into sugar very quickly. It also slows your rate of metabolism, so you get a double whammy. And so the best thing to substitute for alcohol is water, you know, or any beverage like that. And if you can, or vegetable juices, if you want to move in that direction.
Well, I'm looking at a comment, and let me thank you for the call, John. Martin says, please ask the doctor about the health benefits or negative effects of drinking coffee and wine, products at the center of so many daily lives and frequent debates.
Well, you know, coffee is a stimulant, and there are a lot of mixed studies on that. But in general, small amounts of coffee, you know, one or two cups a day are fine for most people. I'm very caffeine sensitive. I'm like Robin Williams on speed if I have even a cup of decaf. So I've learned not to. This is after 40 years of meditation. This is, you know, so I'm not the best person to ask about coffee. And with wine, you know, it used to be thought that having one or two glasses of wine a day was actually protective. But a study came out in The Lancet last year that actually reviewed all those data and found that that's not really true. Now, I don't prescribe, I don't proscribe alcohol. If you're going to drink, try to limit it to one or two drinks a day. And likewise, if you smoke pot, try to limit that as well. But we don't forbid those things.
We had Peter Sagal on yesterday, and he was talking about making, I'm using his phrase here, fart jokes, because he is a humorist. He's the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And here's Dominic, who writes, I love whole grains, fruits, and nuts, but these foods give me so much severe gas that it is unbearable for me and anyone around me. Any suggestions would be welcome.
Well, he probably said something like, this too shall pass, but... But the fact is, your microbiome changes when you eat a healthy diet. There are a trillion cells that we have that live in coexistence with us. In fact, Michael Pollan, again, wrote a column called Some of My Best Friends Are Germs. They actually keep us in health and balance.
We need that bacteria, don't we?
We need them, that's right. And when you change your diet, when you go on a plant-based diet, the microbiome shifts, and during that time, you may have some gas, but that usually lasts 2 or 3 weeks.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll welcome another caller on, and that's Matt. Matt, join us. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Ornish. First off, I want to thank you very much for all the important contributions and work that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And my question is, I'm a contractor. I'm very physically active, and I enjoy lifting weights. I kind of feel as though I need the extra protein, and I do enjoy meat, so... For someone like me who wants to get healthier, I'm 55, what do I do to replace that perceived protein that I think I may need to feel like I need to maintain that musculature to do the work, the very physical work that I do?
It's a good question. You know, one of the people that's interviewed in this Game Changers film that I mentioned earlier is Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he said, you know, I know the bodybuilding world better than anybody, and he's a vegan.
Better
now.
Than Trump?
Yeah, exactly. I like that Trump was worried that people were trying to poison him, so he's eating McDonald's, you know, because he thinks they're... And I said, well, then you are being poisoned. That's another story.
I mean, he said so many times, I know better than anybody about so many things. I just thought maybe bodybuilding, too.
Yeah, just look at him. But there actually are bodybuilders in this Game Changers film, and they're beautiful, and so you don't really need animal-based protein. In fact, most people get too much protein in this country. But if you really feel like you need to supplement with protein, then supplement it with plant-based protein.
Again, our guest is Dean Ornish, and along with Ann Ornish, he has a new book on. It's called Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. And here's another caller joining us from San Bruno. Brian, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. I wanted to ask, I've been a vegetarian for about going on 7 years, and, you know, it's like it's getting really impossible to eat out, you know, if the restaurant or the deli mixes the utensils with, you know, things that may have had contact with meat, then I just get really sick. And I'm just wondering how you navigate that.
Well, I'm not quite as much a purist in that sense, but I generally find it's getting easier all the time to eat this way because food manufacturers are realizing that's where the demand is right now. But if you go to any good quality restaurant and you say, hey, can you make me a vegetable plate? Ask your chef to pick out the freshest vegetables, let it be his or her choice. Try to do it with as little oil and butter and salt as possible. Then they'll bring you something and you don't have to draw attention to yourself. The other people you're eating with say, well, wow, that looks really good. I didn't see that on the menus. And it's not that hard.
Right. It's the bacteria that is giving me the problems, like the bacteria from like meats that may have contacted the utensils.
So. I don't know. I haven't really found that to be a problem, but I'm sorry that it's been an issue for you.
I hope you can resolve it, Brian, and we thank you for the call. Could you say something? We've been talking about coffee and alcohol and... What about marijuana? And I especially raise that now because there's new research, which I'm sure you've seen, about marijuana and mental illness, which is not necessarily encouraging for those who like to use cannabis, especially use a lot of it.
I'm sorry, what were we just talking about? Never mind. Bad joke. No, actually, I think that, again, I'm not advocating the use of marijuana, but certainly it's a better drug for most people than alcohol. You know, when you say how many people died from marijuana overdoses last year, the number, of course, is zero. The therapeutic to toxic ratio is like 200 to 300 to 1. But, you know, there are certain people who are, you know, there was an article that came out of the New York Times that said that raised that issue last week. But it was essentially debunked by most people. Those studies really have not been proven.
The ones about mental illness being exacerbated by chronic use of marijuana?
Yeah, particularly things like schizophrenia and so on.
Yeah.
But it's like any drug, you know, there are always anticipated side effects. And I think whatever people choose to do, they need to balance the benefits with the risks. But in the spectrum of what drugs that people use to alter their consciousness, I'm less concerned about marijuana than most others. And the opioid epidemic, I think, is just another example of how people are using these things to address their underlying pain and loneliness and depression with the breakdown of these social networks. They'll say things like, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes and they're always there for me, or opioids kill the, you know, numb the pain, or food, you know, fat coats my nerves and numbs the pain or fills that void, or video games numb the pain, or working all the time is in a more socially acceptable way.
But marijuana is used medically, I mean, by many people.
Absolutely. I mean, it can help with people to help prevent seizures. It can help
with ophthalmic problems.
For glaucoma, yeah, right. You know, there are a lot of good, especially for cancer chemotherapy. I think in balance, I think marijuana is a drug that has been a really, I think it's crazy to be sending people to jail for using it.
Quick question. CBD oil, activists claim it helps reduce free radicals and lower blood sugar. What are your thoughts or recommendation about CBD oil?
CBD oil is actually especially good for reducing inflammation and particularly for people who have seizures.
We can leave it there. We've covered a lot, as always, with you.
Just one last thing is that we're doing this study to reverse Alzheimer's. If you live in the Bay Area, go to ornish.com. We're still recruiting. It's all free. We'd be grateful. And, Michael, you have an amazing show. You're a light in the darkness, and I feel very honored to know you and to be back again. Thank you for having me.
Kind of you to say, and thank you for being back with us. Dean Ornish, again, is founder and president of the nonprofit Preventive Medicine Research Institute, clinical professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and co-author with Ann Ornish of Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We thank you for being a part of the program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.